You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to Soccer Report Extra podcast, World Cup edition. Held off a little bit this week so we could make sure that we knew the names of the finalists and that we now know. France winning, beating Belgium 1-0, and then, of course, England losing 2-1 in extra time to Croatia on Wednesday. So I don't think you could consider France being the final a total surprise, but I think on the Croatia side of things, that would go down as a shocker. But that's the vagaries of the World Cup. It's a tournament and a lot of strange things happen. But let's start with France against Belgium. So France were coming off win against Argentina. They then beat Uruguay and then facing up to a Belgian team that put the favourites, Brazil, out. So I think there was a lot of movement towards Belgium. But Owen, that Belgium side that played against France didn't, whether it was a case of them not playing well enough or they weren't allowed to play well enough, it was certainly a very different Belgian side than we saw against Brazil, particularly in the first half.
I think it probably said a lot about the Brazilian side. You know, I think it said a lot about, you know, what I find in World Cups is that you, in the course of 90 minutes or 120 minutes, whatever it is, you find out a lot about a certain particular team. And I think that, you know, before the Brazilian game, Belgium came in off the back of that, you know, exhilarating 3-2 performance against Japan. But, you know, in that particular game, they were 2-0 down and you know, very, very easily they could have found themselves going out of the tournament. And then, you know, you find yourself coming up against a Brazilian side that we were not quite sure about. I think we both figured that, you know, that the Brazilians didn't have much of a test quite yet in the tournament, and it would be interesting to see how they would respond to coming against a decent side. And when they did against Belgium, they seemed to struggle. But in saying that, I mean, I think we all felt that the France-Belgium semi-final was, for whatever reason, going to be a kind of a thriller. And it was almost like a sleepy thriller. You know, I think on the outside looking in, it may not have been a goal fest or, you know, massively entertaining with, you know, huge chances from end to end. But I think that it was a reflection of this tournament where you had another close fought, very, very tight affair that was still very, very riveting to watch. In saying that, I think that, you know, in terms of the Belgian performance, there was, I'm sure there's a lot of regret. There's a lot in terms of both maybe managerial and from a personnel perspective, that they may have felt that on another given day they would have changed things and tried to do things in a different way. But in saying that, I think France have been a kind of I'm not quite sure what the best term is to define France in this World Cup, but ruthless is perhaps close enough to it. They always seem to do just about enough. They never massively launch into a completely entertaining, free-flowing, expansive, expressive sort of style of play. But you always feel that there may be an extra gear for them to go through. And certainly in that game against Belgium, that was kind of what you felt. Whereas Belgium maybe lacked something, you always felt maybe that France could go through that extra gear and come up with something if they needed to.
Yeah, I described them on a radio interview I did as being solid. And I think to some extent, Belgium against Brazil tipped to Belgium's hands and tipped Roberto Martinez's kind of approach a little bit. So I think going into this game, France were determined they were not going to allow what happened to Brazil to happen to them. And they just didn't allow the space. Like, you know, Lukaku played through the middle and De Bruyne have kind of floated around in the France game as opposed to this, you know, Lukaku out to the right and De Bruyne playing as a false nine or withdrawn nine.
Yeah.
But they just didn't give them the space to do it. Like Kante was excellent. Pogba, I thought, was very solid. Matuidi, I think, is absolutely brilliant for these two. because it's interesting. I remember the old Eric Cantona one describing Didier Deschamps as a water carrier. But that's exactly what Tweedy does as well, and he needs to do it. And he does it so very well. Like he's technically an okay player, but I think positionally and discipline wise, and his work rate and his tenaciousness, he makes it just absolutely ideal for that midfield, because he just snaps into tackles. He does exactly what the coach wants him to do. And in that game against Belgium, I think it was a case of taking away the space and not allowing Belgium to have any hope of counterattacking them. The one thing I think that I had a question mark going into this tournament on was France's defence. But generally, yeah. I think Umtiti and Varane have been excellent. The right back's been good. Hernandez has been, capable, I think. But just overall, Hugo Lloris's save on Alderweireld was really crucial, I think. I sort of agree with you. They're not blowing anybody away. They haven't blown anybody away up to now. But not dissimilar to 1998 either, if you look back. They weren't, until that final against Brazil, when they really showed what they could do. You go back to 1998 and France struggled a little bit. Like, they had to go to penalties against Italy.
Laurent Blanc against Paraguay.
Yeah, the silver goal, I think that was at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Pas Chilavert.
Coming through the group stage, as Zidane sent off against, I think it was South Africa or the Saudis. I'm not sure which one it was, and it wasn't a particularly difficult group. So there's certainly certainly similarities between the two. What's your kind of thoughts on Martinez was getting lots of praise for the performance against Brazil and the approach he took. But what surprised me, France set up differently, but he never really seemed to have a counter to that in the semi-final.
No,
we didn't really see much that was different.
I thought that, particularly in that first half, what you had was Hazard absolutely bossing it. I think Benjamin Pavard, who's obviously had a bit of to use a North American term, a breakout tournament in many respects, I think had twisted blood at some stage, because Hazard was absolutely running riot. And I felt that Deschamps was actually risky in terms of not changing it. I mean, Hazard had so much of the ball and was, so much of that was going through him. And then for whatever reason, it just seemed to change with Belgium. Was it Martinez slacking off, or was it Deschamps getting an upper hand? I'm not too sure. I think the one question mark in terms of that Belgian performance maybe is in that attacking trio, how so much of the game could have bypassed Romelu Lukaku. I think that's where a lot of the spotlight fell during that game, where he just wasn't really getting a kick. And obviously he was so effective in the game beforehand. You felt that maybe he was coming into a certain degree of form in terms of stepping in and being that leading man, but ultimately it was Hazard again for Belgium. And even watching as the second half developed, Hazard dropping deeper to get into the play, trying to get something going, and that's where you want Hazard. You want Hazard picking a ball up from a centre half or from a full back and being penned back in that zone. Whereas, you really want that type of player to get on the ball in that final third, drop the shoulder, take a player on, and suddenly it opens up in front of him. And then you can get that little bit of movement going. And I think that that's just where something was just amiss with Belgium there. Because ultimately, I mean, you mentioned it. Varane and Umtiti, particularly the centre halves. But in that first half, I mean, the chance that Hazard had when he cut inside and unleashed that shot, and Varane got a touch and went over the bar. It still seemed that Belgium had what it took to open things up a little bit. But It just for whatever reason, I think that there was a couple of changes that Martinez made that were surprising. I think bringing Fellaini off was an unusual move. I thought that, we talked on the podcast before about the effectiveness of Fellaini when you really need something to happen. It's cliche, it's stereotypical, but it's kind of effective to have him there as a plan B. And as you mentioned, when it did come to looking up your sleeve and seeing what you had there, I'm not really sure Martin has had much left. And
when he brought Carrasco on,
oh yeah,
I just shook my head. Like, he is just too flaky.
Yeah, I mean, there's 100%. I mean, you're it's almost like what I felt watching Portugal earlier in the tournament with Quaresma. Quaresma. Yeah, I mean, he'll get plaudits for scoring that audacious goal with the out of his right foot. For 99.9% of the time, he tries step overs and ends up falling over. And you think, right, well, that's actually who he is. And like that with somebody like Carrasco, it's just not a reliable guy to bring on in a knockout round of a World Cup to try and get something going.
I thought they really missed Munier down that right side.
Completely. I thought he had a great tournament. Yeah,
I think he's been one of the understated stars of the tournament. Like, his crosses and his passing, I think, has been excellent. His work rate as well, because...
And also, yeah, I mean, the way he handled Neymar in that in that quarterfinal as well, which I think was probably a reflection of facing him before PSG against Barcelona.
Yeah.
When Neymar played training there, I think. And yeah, it kind of helps. But, you know, I totally would agree. I think he was strong. Didn't let too much past him at all, and obviously as well cynical enough that if something did get past him, he had the wherewithal to essentially take a man down, concede a foul, and go, right, okay, we'll just get back, regroup and organize yourself from a set piece. It's an interesting one. Obviously Martinez is deserving of certain plaudits for getting his team that far. But again, I mean, I was asked questions before that game about Belgium, and I said, you know what? Can Belgium answer the big question about mentality? You know, that we always talk about how much glittering sort of personnel that they have and how talented they are, but can they get over that line? And once again, you have to kind of say that they didn't, and there's only so much that you can gloss over that and think a bigger picture and all that sort of stuff. When it came down to it, they just didn't really have that cutting edge anymore.
I got the impression, and I'm not sure this is necessarily fair because it's just an impression, but I got the impression that they hadn't actually left the Brazil game behind. And tournaments, it's amazing in tournaments how often a team goes out after its best result.
Yeah.
Like, you look at Sweden, you know, they get through that group, they beat Switzerland, they're in the last eight,
yeah,
they don't turn up against England, right? There's a pattern to these down the years, and I think that's perhaps makes the difference between the winners and the losers at a World Cup or a Nations Cup, or I always call it a Nations Cup, but European Championships, Copa America, whatever. It's the ability to focus on the next game rather than getting carried away with what you've just done. It's what you have to do. It doesn't matter if you're knocked out the favourite. If you haven't won it yet, it really doesn't mean that very much. Anyway, that brings us to the end of part one. We'll be back with part two, and we'll be talking Croatia and England.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra. Keep up to speed with the podcast and get all the latest news, musings and rants from Bobby and Owen by liking us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to part two of the Soccer Report Extra podcast, World Cup edition. Looking back at this two semi-finals, we've already covered France and Belgium, and now we move on to Croatia and England. Croatia, for the third time in the knockout stage, coming back from being behind. Twice has gone to penalty kicks, but this time they faced extra time again, but did it in extra time, didn't need penalty kicks. All I can say is Croatia 2, England 1, and England's coming home.
Or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I don't really want to admit so much to our podcast audience in terms of being partisan and all that. But what I will say is that this was a very, very dramatic semi-final and remarkable in terms of, you know, whatever result kind of was conjured in this game, it would have been a remarkable eventuality, which I think says a lot about this tournament. You know, Croatia or England in a World Cup final is just absolutely inexplicable. As it turned out, you know, was I disappointed with England? I'm not really sure. I think England have remained quite consistent throughout this tournament. And I think I wasn't quite sure about England at the start of this tournament. And I wasn't quite sure about England in the semi-final, to be perfectly honest. So, I mean, could English... like, English fans were coming up to me after, you know, I was watching this game in the middle of Toronto, and English fans were coming up to me and asking me questions about the game. And I said, to be honest, I said, I think that you've had a very good tournament. I think you've reached a semi-final. It's overachieving, really. It's been totally without drama in terms of off-field stuff. It's been a refreshing experience for everybody. It's breathed a little bit of optimism and a little bit of positivity into your country, you know, when it needed it most. And I think that's great. And I think any kind of comparisons to be made with 1990 are a good thing. I mean, that was a great tournament for England, and it was something to cherish.
Bloody awful for everybody else watching.
Horrible for everyone else, except maybe Ireland. But you know, I what I will say is, Jesus, I mean, I was watching this on, there was World Feed commentary, right? And World Feed, you would think it's the World Feed, right? You know, and God...
Was this Peter Drury?
It was Peter fucking Drury, and God bless him. Like, I understand that Peter Drury is an English man, right? But there was about, I think, 10 references to 1966, right? And a World Cup victory for England. Now, if I'm watching this game and I have no idea about either of these teams and it's a World Feed, the level of fucking flag waving going on from the World Feed commentator was absolutely astounding. Like, at the very beginning, he was talking about how, we stand at this moment and you think back to 1966, 1990, Alf Ramsey, Bobby Robson, both of those people became Sir Alf Ramsey, Sir Bobby Robson. What does that mean about Gareth South? I mean, hang on. I'm like, literally, hang on a second.
Sir Gareth of the waistcoat.
Sir, I mean, like, really? Anyway, that's the end of my rant on that. Yeah. In terms of the game, most importantly, I thought...
Sorry, before you get into the game,
sorry,
can I just,
go on.
Just add a few things here?
Yes.
Because at the moment, you know, the initial media responses, didn't the boys do well? They gave it all, you know, they were proud of them, blah, blah, blah. I suspect 6 months from now, that's going to be different. Because I think 6 months from now, they're going to wake up and they're going to realise what a big chance they missed.
Huge.
It would just, you look at, in everything, you know, Luka Modric's comment about how the English media had got them, got Croatia riled by constantly talking about how tired they were and all the rest. The conventional narrative was the last 20 minutes, were, if it was a tied game with 20 minutes to go, England were going to boss the game and take it over and win. They didn't. It worked the other way. And here's the thing. England lost that game for the same reason they'd got as far as they did. They got as far as they did because they took their chances, but they're a functional team, and the function, particularly the functional aspect of it, was the midfield. Mm. They didn't have a creative player in midfield. They were a functional unit. That's what killed them, I think, against Croatia. They didn't have quality players in the middle of the park that could actually control a game. They were there in the previous games more as, to use the phrase you used before, the water carriers. Get the ball, move it on. Get the ball, move it on. Play the safe ball, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they did not have a Modric. They did not have a Rakitic, but they particularly did not have a Modric. I thought Modric, over the knockout rounds of the World Cup, has been absolutely fantastic.
I think that watching this, you know, particularly in the first half, Croatia were sluggish and they found it tough, and what was happening was Kane was dropping deeper and allowing Sterling up top to try and hit them on the break. And that obviously restricted the space around the Croatian central zone. And they were finding it difficult, Rakitic and Modric were finding it difficult to find pockets of space. And obviously that's what you want. I just felt that at halftime, even a little bit of a change could just open Croatia up a little bit, because it was clear that they were growing frustrated at not being able to get their key players, on the ball. You know,
they wouldn't be able to create chances.
And I think, Rebic 1v1 against Young was probably their best outlet. That seemed, even Perisic was largely anonymous in that first period. And to be honest, I just felt, because Croatia just had not played at all, I just felt England should have had much more control of the game than they did. But going by the way that they set up, it meant that they were playing on the counter. It meant that, at any stage, really, when Sterling got possession, he had to wait. He had to wait for more bodies to get up in support of him. Obviously, Kane is a centre forward. So the way that they
played today as a number 10.
Exactly. Yeah, it was just a little bit of a change. I just felt that because of how poor Croatia had been, I was like, God, England going into that dressing room 1-0 ahead. I wonder what the sentiment is in the Croatian dressing room. I wonder if Croatia are going in there, looking around at each other and saying, lads, we haven't even started playing yet. And we're only a goal. There's only still a goal in it.
But you look at it, and I don't know where you're going in this, Owen, but I'll throw this in. It, to me, when I watched Croatia against Russia on, I guess that was back on Sunday, when Croatia made the change and they pushed Rakitic and Modric further forward,
yeah.
but they pushed them forward in quite a narrow. It was more like a diamond,
yeah,
kind of midfield they had. And Kramaric was kind of the top of that diamond. I thought the interesting thing they did in the game against England was they actually pushed Modric just a little bit wider, and I think that's what started getting them the space. And then it worked against England because they couldn't control the ball through the midfield, began hitting long balls.
Yeah.
And the long balls just got picked off by Vida, who I thought was terrific. Mm. Lovren, who came into a better game. Vrlačko, the right back, I thought was a super game as well. Left back, I'm not quite so sure about Strinic, but generally the ball was just coming straight back, and it just set off this downward spiral of things just getting worse for England, because they didn't have the confidence to give it to somebody, and they didn't, like, you watch Croatia and Modric showed for every pass.
Yeah. And I think as well, I mean, it came back to, somebody was asking me at halftime, and I said, to be honest, what I would encourage the Croatian players to do is just say, listen, let's keep the ball, and let's try and stretch things a little bit more than we have done. It was a little bit narrow in that first half. Just stretch it and give that English midfield something to grow concerned about. Because in the first half, I think it was a little bit of Croatia not being able to lay even much of a glove on England.
No, they couldn't get close to them.
And I think that's kind of what happened in the second half. Just things got a little bit stretched. Suddenly there was a bit more space for those Croatian shirts. And that's really where it's key. Now you have a touch, you can take a second touch and you can wait for a runner and inject a little bit of pace. You can change the angle of a run and you can just give the opposition something different to worry about. And also, throughout that second half, England just could not get any bit of momentum together. Like what you alluded to, it was that long ball out of defence. And the thing is, long ball is fine if you're actually set up to deal with that. If you're set up to play with that in mind. But they obviously withdrew Sterling. They by the end of the game, they had a radically different shape than what they had starting off. And
the whole Rashford Sterling debate, I think, certainly in the context of that game, was put to bed for me, because I think England looked a far better team. Now, maybe he was tired and maybe that was part of the plan, but Rashford, I thought, was a bit of a blunt instrument. I think Croatia defenders just lapped him up. He saw them as a kind of physical challenge more than a tactical challenge.
Yeah.
And I think they were just they were much more comfortable playing against Rashford than they were against Sterling, who was more taking on more intelligent positions perhaps and making them think a little bit harder.
And, you know, like
as I've said for a long, long time, the last thing defenders want to do is think.
Exactly, and I think as well that even the introduction of someone like Vardy was wasted because at that stage Croatia were so compact defensively. Vardy.
Did he get a kick of the ball?
I don't even know if he did. I mean, like Vardy absolutely plays to the vulnerabilities of a high defence, trying to get in behind and using that pace. And Croatia were so tight and so compact. You were scratching your head thinking, well, why is he on the pitch? Like, I mean, you know, Croatia have got deeper here. They're sitting in.
Would Vardy for Sterling have made more sense than Rashford for Sterling, do you think?
Possibly, but, you know, I just think at that stage, you know, you're trying to get across. I mean, like that, you're talking about Belgium earlier on and in terms of a plan B and some sort of strategy. I'm not sure if there was a genuine enough alternative in terms of England having to force the issue a little bit. It just seemed to be throwing stuff at throwing the paint at a blank wall and hoping that some of it will stick. And I think, to be honest, there was a part of me as well that I felt that Croatia could see that. I think that when you see Rashford, when you see Vardy, if you're a Croatian player, you think, hang on a sec, we know where this is going. You know, that this now is them panicking a little bit. They're exhausting every sort of attacking outlet they have from the bench, and they're just worrying. There doesn't seem to be a cohesive plan to deal with them being in this situation.
And I think that's kind of interesting. You point that out as well, because you look at and I'm not comparing it to Croatia, because Croatia have a couple of, I think the fact that Kovacic has stayed on the bench today, and he's a very, very good player. But you look at the English bench, they used Marcus Rashford, they used Danny Rose Dyer and Jamie Vardy. But you look beyond that, there's not a lot of experience depth that players you could maybe throw on and say, you know, here's a player that can control the midfield, or here's a player that can change things up front. You're looking at like Danny Welbeck, Ruben Loftus-Cheek. That was it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and listen, you don't want to be too harsh on England. I mean, they've kind of enjoyed it. Like, to be honest, at the start of the tournament, you could kind of plot a bit of a course for England through this. I mean, if other results went their way. I mean, I had them tipped to beat Colombia in the second round, but I thought that they would go out to Germany in the quarterfinals. I think in my estimation, they certainly have overachieved given what they have at their disposal. But I think that you have to look at things within a context. I think that, like, as you point out, you're in a World Cup semi-final and you look to change things, and the alternative that you have on the bench is Danny Welbeck. I mean, I think that is a real, genuine eye-opener for everyone. England in this World Cup had to come through a relatively easy group. Let's face it, it was either going to be them or Belgium who topped the group. You're into a knockout stage. You get a bit of momentum. You get a bit of good fortune. Who knows, you're in a quarterfinal. And they did. They got a good fortune that Germany were already out of the competition. And they come up against Sweden, who obviously, as you mentioned, had kind of run out of ideas by the quarterfinals, really. And suddenly they find themselves in a semi against Croatia. I mean, In terms of this tournament and in terms of the quality of this English side, that is, it's
so what you're really saying. What you're saying here, Owen, is you're blaming the Germans.
I'm basically blaming anyone I can. I just think that, you know, World Cup is very unusual. There's a lot of ingredients, you know, that makes a tournament go in certain directions. And I think that this is not a great England side. You know, it really isn't. Yes, they have got to a semi-final of a World Cup. That does not mean that, in any fashion, that they are a great team.
But it's established a benchmark in the minds of the public and established a benchmark in the minds of the media.
Yeah.
Do you not think it's going to set up the same old dynamic of suddenly when we get into qualifying for a European championship, the expectations immediately coming out this tournament is England are going to win 220.
Well, that's complete bollocks. And I'm sorry. I mean, like, that's absolutely ridiculous stuff.
Bollocks because I said it, or bollocks that it's true?
No, bollocks that it's true. I mean, like, because how, give me an example of where that's, I mean, what, Spain? Like, I mean, in Italia 90, they fucking came through, you know, and reached the semi-finals and got to a third or fourth place playoff and didn't even qualify for Euro 92. And, you know, Sir Bobby Robson.
Oh, yeah, they did.
Did they?
Did they not? Did
they, maybe, sorry.
I think they did.
And they got knocked out. And they got knocked out, sorry.
Yeah. But they didn't get to 94.
No, and so that prolonged, it took between 1990 effectively and to 1996 for them to recapture that sort of spirit. So, if you were going on that logic, yeah, they would have won the European Championships in 1992 because, oh, well, you know, it's real Britannia. Everything's rosy. It doesn't work like that. I mean, sometimes it's capturing something in a bottle and it's about chemistry and it's about an environment and you're not sure that environment's going to be the same. It really is like a club. It's like, you know, certain personnel work great in a certain dressing room. If they go somewhere else, it changes the dynamic and you can never recapture it. You know, it's not a simple equation, you know, X plus Y equals XY. I mean, if it was all that easy, you know, everyone would do it. But I think I just think that, like that, you have to apply context to this World Cup for England. And, you know, for the most part, like, let's face it, who do they beat in this World Cup in 90 minutes? Sweden.
Well, they could theoretically go home with a 1-3, lost 3, one penalty kick record.
You know, and I think that's, you know, and listen, they just, you know, they did great. But I mean, it's important to keep the other stuff in your mind moving forward. It's important to keep that, you know, when we want to change things, here's Ruben Loftus-Cheek coming on. Listen, I've got nothing against, you know, that particular guy as a player, but, you know, in terms of a World Cup and in terms of the future of English football.
I mean, maybe 4 years from now, but not now.
Yeah, I just, you know, you have to come back to that. I mean, like, let's face it, you look at, you know, somebody, a team like France, you know, and we'll talk about this in a second, but, like, you know, this French team has been simmering really for 4 years. You know, it's you know, it had a World Cup, it came through European Championships like a cycle, and now it's a second World Cup. And it's kind of been, yeah, it's just been left on the stove, just like, you know, let's come back to it in a little while, see if it's done enough. You know, the England team, yeah, they've got a certain amount of ingredients that are great and steady. But in terms of the bulk of the squad, I think there's certainly things that you would like to be better. And I think Gareth Southgate is the type of guy who will say, semi-finals of a World Cup, I would take it any day of the week, because stepping into this job, it was chaos. Everything was all over the place. It was a pantomime, lots of theatrics, lots of off-the-field stuff. We've managed to get to a semi-final of a major tournament. Hallelujah. You know, I'll drink to that.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of part two of Soccer Report Extra World Cup Edition podcast. And we'll be back with part three in just a second.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan. Be sure to follow them both on Twitter. Links are in the show notes below. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to part three of the Soccer Report Extra podcast, World Cup edition. France and Croatia will play for the World Cup on Sunday in Moscow. And Owen, one thing that could win the cup for France and one thing that could win the cup for Croatia.
Okay, right. We're taking France first. I think that their relentlessness in the middle of the park has been really, really impressive. I think I've been his biggest critic for a long time, but Paul Pogba for me has been very, very mature, very, very calm, very responsible. And obviously he's had such a great foil in N'Golo Kante. And I think that French midfield has kind of been a bit of an unsung sort of ingredient. I think that the likes of Mbappe, defensively, the likes of Pavard and Varane and Umtiti have kind of maybe dominated the spotlight a little bit, but I think that midfielders has been really, really solid. So I think that if France could get that right again, possibly shut down the likes of Modric and Rakitic and stop or at least stem that sort of dynamic from wielding as much influence as possible. That's a big thing for France. And on the other side of that, I think Croatia, I mean, one of the biggest and most impressive things about that semi-final victory over England was defensively. I have to say, I think I was prepared for, as they were, clearly, English set pieces. I think that from corners, from free kicks, they were really, really good and really, really dogged. Obviously, Trippier scored from one, but in terms of the actual deliveries into the area, I think Croatia handled them pretty well. They knew what to expect. I think Vida had a terrific game. I think Lovren grew into it. So I think defensively, that central defence pairing, you know, they will face a little bit of a different proposition. Mbappe trying to beat them with pace. In fairness, I think Sterling, you know, England were trying to play on the break a long time. Vida was perfectly kind of prepared for that. So I think that if they're to get that edge, maybe frustrate France, that central defensive pairing, if they could stand up again and be as imposing and impressive as they were in that semi-final, they'll stand definitely a chance.
Yeah, the way I kind of look at it, I know Croatia have come back three times from being a goal down. Russia won kind of a bit of a seesaw one. But I think if Croatia have a chance of winning the World Cup, they've got to get the first goal and they've got to put France in a position that they've rarely been in this tournament. There was that situation when Argentina went 2-1 up. But basically, and they handled it quite well, but I think the only way to put some doubt and to really challenge the French is to get that first goal. And so I see if Croatia has got a chance to win this tournament, win this World Cup, then that first goal is vital for them. On the French side, I just think I agree with you, the midfield has been solid. But Mbappe on that right side against Stranic, I think is just an unfair, potentially a very unfair matchup. He's just, the Croatian left back is so laid back. He's like a California surfer out there. He's so laid back. And
Strinic came off in that England semi-final as well.
I think he's come off a couple of times, hasn't he? Because he came off in the game against Russia as well. Is it Pivanic, I think, came in his place?
I think so,
Pivanic came on left back and Strinic went off. So I think the French will have seen that. I think, you know, if they can find a way of kind of maybe tilting the play a little bit to that left side and then find a way of freeing up Mbappe against Strinic, I think that could be key to France becoming the world champions for the second time in, I guess, 20 years. Not a bad run, actually, if they do that, right? Two World Cups in 20 years plus one runners-up.
Yeah.
And two insurrections.
Absolute, you know, a couple of civil wars thrown in there. you know, one most infamous handball from Thierry Henry. It's certainly two decades, you know, with
and you throw in there was Euros in 2000 as well, right?
Yeah, very much so. They've gone through a litany of coaches to try and get it right. And then
2016 runners-up.
Yeah, and to, you know, say what you will about Deschamps and he's got his detractors. I mean, I remember you go back to Jose Mourinho and his Porto team facing Deschamps' Monaco in that Champions League final and he was completely out-tacticked, as Sam Allardyce would put it, and Monaco were a little bit embarrassed that night. But he was a certain type of player, and I'm sure you can argue that he coaches in a certain type of way as well. I'm sure there's a lot of people who would prefer to see this French team, his French team, be a lot more exuberant and expressive when they have the opportunity to be so. And yet, like I said earlier on, you always feel that they've just got an extra gear to go through. He's pretty meticulous in terms of that mindset. You know, he was... I mean, he just won all around him as a player. You know, you go back to his Marseille days. You know, and there's a special type of winner And I think in many ways, Deschamps is that kind of modern footballer, you know, come coach. It's like, you know, yeah, people might point a finger and he's a bit of an easy target, but he's got the job done. He's got the job done as a player, and he seems to be getting the job done as a coach as well. You know, it wasn't, you know, the French job is not an easy job to take on. You know, Laurent Blanc found that, and Deschamps came in. Deschamps, you know, led them to a European Championship final. The country of France had been through a very, very traumatic and turbulent time itself, just a couple of months previous with a massive terror attack. And, you know, a lot can be said about this football team. A lot can be said about, you know, the kind of the influence that it has, you know, how far it goes in terms of a little bit of a microcosm and a little bit of a metaphor. He's done a good job. And, you know, I tipped them at the start of the tournament to get to a final, and they'll definitely go into this game as favourites for it. I think that's absolutely sure.
So now we're coming to prediction time. So as we stand, it's McMahon 33 right, 29 wrong.
Yeah.
Owen 31-31. So I think you've got your predictions written down. I've got mine predictions written down, but I should go first, because you could tie this up. We might have to go to penalties on Sunday night. So I'm going in the third place game. I'm going Belgium 2, England 1. And for the final, I'm going France 3, Croatia 1.
I am going in the third, fourth place playoff, Belgium to win. Do we need to specify results? Yeah, is that part of the deal?
Yeah, because that'd be that's a tiebreaker. Correct results.
I think it's going to be Belgium 2-1 after extra time.
Oh, AET.
AET. Okay. FYI. OMG.
Yeah.
And in the World Cup final, I think that France are going to win, and I think France are going to win by 2-0.
Okay, so that the only thing that's left is to play the two games, right? It's we'll be, I'm sure we'll have a chance to summarize the tournament and probably on Sunday night with the podcast for next week. But before we go, apparently some Portuguese players been transferred to Italy. You hear that? Did you see that one coming?
You know, we talked about Ronaldo and his future way, way back this season in podcasts. And our hardcore listeners will remember it, because I think we were at pains to say, listen, whatever their exit strategy is, they won't need to look at it right now, but it's something that they will need to look at. And the fucking guy turns around and leaves him at the end of the season.
The thing is that did they have an exit strategy, or Ronaldo imposed this exit strategy on them?
I think that had a lot to do. I mean, firstly, I think if you're Ronaldo, I think it's hard to look beyond the change in coach. And also, I think it's, you know, he's got the people around him to say, listen, Zidane's walked because Zidane can't do better than what he's just done.
Yeah.
So you have a decision to make. Either you're going to sit there and watch a coaching transition take place, and God only knows what it means in terms of your club's performance, or you can decide to get out of jail now. You can still, you know, rake in a massive amount of money. You can ensure another huge transfer fee at 33 years old.
Yeah.
And you can go to a team where, to be honest, you could genuinely make a seismic difference to them, possibly in the short term, figuring stuff out. And, I mean, a 33-year-old getting a 4-year contract, getting the money that he's on. He's now, what, joint third in terms of record transfers? He's now got two of the top 8 record transfers in history, Ronaldo.
Mm-hmm.
At 33, this is what, 9 years after the move from Manchester United. Yeah. So at 24, when you think, all right, this is where a player is going to get, you know, this is peak value for a player when they're signed to a club. Ronaldo's actually gone at 33 when there's absolutely no return on investment, and he's smashed what Real Madrid paid for him in 2009. He's now got genuine possibility of more than likely finishing his time at Juventus. Probably not going to reach Del Piero in terms of goal-scoring stats. He could finish as the second highest scorer in Juventus history. And that's even just being there three or four seasons. He's got a four-year contract. It's wholly possible that Ronaldo will be a Juventus club legend, as well as a Real Madrid club legend, as well as a Manchester United legend.
Do you think you'll put Juventus over the top in terms of Champions League? Because it's really what this is about, yeah. Is it not? The Champions League.
I was trying to figure this out. I was trying to figure out what the team will do and what the team will look like, because obviously Ronaldo is now a centre forward. You know, he's a number nine. Yes. So does that mean that Higuain, you know, we can't really count on Higuain to have a starting role anymore? Because, you know, you also look at
but they did play together at Real Madrid as well, didn't they?
They did, but with Ronaldo in that different role, wasn't it? I mean, it was Higuain to the middle,
wide role.
And Ronaldo was wide, and obviously Higuain left, and Ronaldo just stepped into that. I just cannot see now Ronaldo in
but
that.
But the Real Madrid Ronaldo as a striker through the centre scenario has very much been dependent on Benzema,
true.
Is it not?
Yeah, I mean,
like the fact that he's willing to do the hard work and create the space for Ronaldo to take. It's not like Ronaldo generally has been that kind of static centre forward.
True.
It's been about creating space and allowing him to arrive in the box.
Yeah, and
at appropriate times.
What excites me about the Juventus thing is that, you know, when you're trying to figure out the lineup and how it'll all come together, Dybala and Costa and Ronaldo, you're kind of thinking to yourself, wow, you know, it's exciting.
I think the Costa one's really interesting there. I wouldn't be surprised if they sold Dybala. I wouldn't be surprised if they finished up maybe even selling Higuain as well. But I can't see both of them staying around, because even though there's rumours of Fiat coming in with a big sponsorship deal for him to close that gap between what he was earning at Real Madrid and what he's going to earn at Juventus, I think Juventus are going to have to run a pretty tight ship. I know they'll be looking at some more revenue coming in, but they're not going to make any more money from TV. Champions League, there's not much top-up to be made there, because they've cleaned up in the last few years. So I think they may have to dispose of some players. So, which leads me to the final question in terms of Ronaldo. Who do Real Madrid go and sign now on? Because they're not going to sit still, are they?
Well, I mean, well, it's weird because, you look at timing, right? I mean, you look at the club and where they are. I mean, they've obviously had the huge, you know, you have to say a negative press of the Spanish World Cup odyssey and how they were to blame for it, and Perez and, you know, Lopetegui and how that's going to work. Lopetegui, I mean, surely, you know, if he didn't have regrets before this, he's now walking into a club that's just lost their prized possession. Surely he has massive regrets now. I mean, what a thankless task going in there. And I'm sure he'll get the usual thing. Listen, there's no pressure on you. We know that Ronaldo's just been so, you know, and all that sort of stuff. Of course, huge pressure on him to go in and try and hit the ground running. As you said, where do you go now? How do you replace the irreplaceable? And also as well, for any player that does come in, you talk about expectation and you talk about responsibility. Yeah. There's absolutely what I can only try and figure out is you buy a couple of players and you hope that through a collaborative process that you can even get close to the amount of goals that Ronaldo was giving you, that you can get close to the amount of influence that Ronaldo had for you on a pitch. Because if you're trying to get like for it, you're never going to get it.
Do you think there's any chance that they are going to go after Neymar? I personally don't think it'd be a good move.
Personally, I don't think so either. I don't really see. I mean, I think certainly when he was at Barcelona, Neymar was part of a team. I think that that also worked in Ronaldo's, you know, Ronaldo obviously was, you know, has a huge ego and he is a huge individual, but there was players on that pitch capable of stepping up when they needed to. You mentioned Benzema, you mentioned Benzema particularly, but there was Bale, there was Isco. There's a couple of players there who can do a bit of a job for them. I just can't really see Neymar having the influence that Ronaldo had. I think Neymar would go there and presume that he could court that degree of influence, and he'd be sadly mistaken. I don't look at them as being part of the same sentence, and they're for me, they're very, very different players. I mean, you would look at Chelsea, you'd look at Hazard potentially. Yeah. As you know, Chelsea were going through their own transition this summer, managerially. I'm sure Hazard has had a really good World Cup. I think that has to be said as well. Like, he's looked really great. He's slick, quick, skillful. You know, you would be surprised if Madrid haven't put his name down on a shortlist.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's
do you think Kane comes into the equation?
Wow, it's a good question. I mean, I think you've spoken about that before. I think what Kane would get you and would provide for any team is that ruthlessness in an area. You know, anything that comes in that box, Kane has that very, very innate skill of sending it to the back of the net, and not a lot of players have that. I mean, that kind of obsession with scoring goals. And Kane's, yeah, he's certainly you know, part of a very, very small list of players in terms of his goal scoring metrics and what he can provide in front of goal. Will he go? Will he take that risk? I'm not sure, but I think Real Madrid have to be having conversations like this. I think Real Madrid have to be thinking big. I think they have to be thinking about how do we fill this gap.
Well, they haven't spent a lot of money for a while either, have they?
Well, we're a long way from the
Galactico.
Like
big money that they're used to. Yeah. You've got to go back to Gareth Bale in 2013 when they set a world record fee for him. But they've kept their powder dry for some time now, so they've got to have a fair. I think they've got to have a fair kitty, and they've got some room to manoeuvre, not just with the fact they can bank Ronaldo's transfer fee, but they're going to be able to get some. That's going to free up some significant salary space as well now.
Also, I mean, I think any time that you lose such a big player, I think it also opens the risk factor. You know, I think someone on Twitter, somebody much more clever than me, in terms of Ronaldo leaving, you know, you remember when Ronaldo left Manchester yeah. United, and they signed Michael Owen, Gabriel Obertan, like, you know, they just didn't really, you know, manage to fill that gap properly. They tried to do it in a completely different way and got it completely and utterly wrong. So, I mean, what, the most successful signing that summer was what, Valencia? Did he arrive that summer as well? I mean, it does certainly increase the prospect of getting your recruitment wrong. You would have to bank on Real Madrid, even in the smallest way, having been a little bit prepared for this. You know, as in, I don't think the word out of Spain is that they were massively shocked at Ronaldo deciding that he wanted to leave, which would lead you to believe that, you know, they have some sort of a contingency. Now, the thing is, their contingency might be to, you know, flex their muscles and try and bully clubs into releasing certain players because they're Real Madrid, and they just presume that the players will want to come there. I do think that you know, you're right. They need to go big here. You know, you cannot lose a player like Ronaldo and try and temper the, you know, the fans' expectations with a couple of moderate signings. You know, they need to go a bit big, and there's plenty of time left. I think there's plenty of time for Real to maybe drop a little bit of a bombshell in there as well.
Yeah, just remember, the Real Madrid's transfer strategy tends to be a bit like the Chinese war torture. It tends to be a drip over many, many months. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. So that brings us to the end of Soccer Report Extra World Cup plus Ronaldo special. We will be back next week. We'll be talking about the World Cup final and any other interesting going-ons in the world of soccer. On behalf of Ono Callahan, producer Luke Crawford, myself, Bobby McMahon, thanks very much for listening. For someone who's so keen to snuggle, you
cause a lot of trouble. Thanks for listening to Soccer Report Extra. To keep tabs on the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen, like us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Music for this podcast graciously provided by Manitoba's hottest indie pop group, Misery Slims. Check them out on Spotify and YouTube, and follow the band on Facebook at Misery Slims.